of the CIA if necessary. It was the only chance to have any positive impact. For the FBI to trust me, I had to work for them. This trust and respect, of course, was necessary for Mike and others in command to respect my advice and guidance. It was even more crucial for those 100+ FBI agents and analysts under our direction. This was a management leap. I had never supervised more than a couple dozen people. The assignment was an even greater intellectual and cultural challenge. One hard task was learning the differences between law enforcement and intelligence in the counterterrorism arena, while exploring common cause and offering my perspectives to the FBI. Even harder was dealing with the gaps and overlaps in missions and authorities between the two organizations. The first major gulf between them appeared on my first day in early September 1998, when I showed up at the FBI's Strategic Information and Operations Center, SIOC, for the early morning briefing about the massive deployment of FBI agents to Kenya and Tanzania. The SIOC was a tiny room with rudimentary phone systems and audio-visual equipment. It was crammed with people almost shoulder to shoulder in chairs arranged in a semicircle. Oxygen seemed to be at a premium. It was loud. The place reverberated with the machine-like recitation of the briefing points, punctuated by sharp questions and sharper comments. Topics included the roles of different teams and administrative issues. There was a fractured rolling debate about leads, apparently anything from a stray phone number to a suspect's travel records. The SIOC was filled with quite a cast of characters, all apparently intent on briefing. One FBI analyst lectured on the flight of the suspects from East Africa. Another outlined the status of the FBI teams. All of this I understood. But then a scientist provided an update on the forensic work from the crime scenes. Another briefed on the FBI's media strategy. Yet another talked about pending indictments. Lab work? Media? Indictments? At one point, I could not even discern the vocabulary. In his briefing, FBI agent Jim Bernazzani often used a new term to describe the suicide bombers. I was unfamiliar with the word and did not want to embarrass myself by asking its meaning. Others were also clearly confused, and somebody finally yelled out a translation. Bernazzani, in his broad Boston accent, was trying to say martyrs. We all broke up in laughter. Attorney General Janet Reno sent Fran Townsend as her representative to these morning meetings. A petite workhorse with a no-nonsense attitude, Townsend had started her career as a district attorney in New York. Now, as the counsel for intelligence policy, she was the attorney general's point person for the East Africa bombings, not to be confused with U.S. District Attorney Pat Fitzgerald in New York, who was responsible for prosecuting the East Africa bombing cases. The FBI director sent his deputy, Tom Pickard, a steady hand with a sharp wit. But Dale Watson seemed to run the SIOC show, with barked commands and a string of questions. I sat there like a tribal outsider, observing a new culture as participants slung facts, figures, guesstimates, and other details around the tiny room. People scratched a few notes and referred to some administrative documents, but for the most part there was minimal operational, evidentiary intelligence reporting in written form. I realized that Dale, Fran, Mike, and others seemed to have developed extraordinary memories for details delivered by lecture. This was a tribe that valued oral stories and history. I came from a tribe that treasured the written intelligence report. Over the coming weeks, I would learn to keep track of this growing international investigation, and I was both impressed and disappointed. The after-the-fact investigation was extraordinary, particularly the surge of mass force. The FBI agents demonstrated great tenacity. They interviewed hundreds of people, searched AQ's safe sites, including the sewer of one Dar es Salaam home, for evidence, analyzed every part of the crime scenes, and worked tirelessly to identify and track the AQ operatives. By early September, two AQ operatives had been captured, transported to New York, and arraigned in federal court. One was a Yemeni named Mohammed Rashed Daoud Alawali. The other was Mohammed Sadiq Odeh, a Palestinian. By December, another five had been indicted. They came from East Africa, the Middle East, South Asia, and even the Comoros, a tiny island nation in the Indian Ocean. The FBI and CIA worked well together, particularly in the field. Overall, the shared information led to better FBI evidence and CIA intelligence. This was reflected in the eventual arrest or death of many of the plot's perpetrators. Working with the FBI and CIA, police in South Africa, Pakistan, and Kenya detained some of the fugitives. In the coming years, the CIA and local allies killed others in Afghanistan and elsewhere. My disappointment had to do with the FBI's exclusive focus on law enforcement, on capture and indictments of specific criminals for specific crimes. Forward-looking intelligence collection and analysis were almost non-existent. The FBI sought justice, not prevention. Their information was potential evidence, which they had to protect for the prosecutors to use in court. The agents, for the most part, could not envision others outside the Department of Justice having a legitimate need for FBI-derived information. Sharing evidence as intelligence was anathema to them. Even the FBI's New York field office would not share information with FBI HQS because of their incentive for a successful prosecution in the Department of Justice's Southern District of New York. For me, at first, this was strange and perplexing, but I eventually realized the deep systemic constraints in the law enforcement system when it involved intelligence. There was no secret about it. The FBI even referred to the Chinese Wall, constructed to prevent tainting evidence by sharing it with the intelligence community or anybody outside the prosecutor's office. The whole concept was maddening, but it seemed written in stone, and I made no headway in breaching that wall. It was considered a sacrosanct barrier, not to be challenged. On the policy end, I was equally disappointed in the failure to address AQ's obvious act of war. On 20 August 1998, President Clinton ordered cruise missile strikes against six AQ sites in Afghanistan and a pharmaceutical factory in Khartoum, Sudan. The enemy suffered a few casualties and some damaged infrastructure, but no more. As the weeks rolled by, the U.S. did nothing more to exercise its military might. AQ grew more confident than ever, believing there was little to fear. They were correct. There was no substantive U.S. response except for the pursuit of those AQ operatives involved in the bombings and other limited CIA clandestine operations. The White House and Congress seemed to view the attack on our embassies as a law enforcement issue, not war. Mike Rowlands and I discussed this. He was all for waging war, but expressed concern about how to fight this type of conflict. He and others in the FBI noted their frustration with the lack of counterparts or international writ in Afghanistan. They, of course, had no way to reach into the country and make an arrest. They had warrants on UBL and others, but so what? This was the first time that I realized that war itself was changing and the U.S. government was not organized to understand the enemy and not prepared to fight in this new environment. Law enforcement alone was not the answer. Neither was covert action. Conventional military force alone would not work. Economic sanctions would have minimal impact. Diplomacy with AQ was impossible. What about the role of intelligence? It had to grow. It had to identify threats, discern enemy forces, and guide U.S. power. This included our homeland. By November 1998, after the initial shock of my shift from unilateral CIA spy to FBI executive had dissipated, I asked an FBI analyst a simple question. What is the status of the FBI investigations against AQ in the U.S. homeland? I don't know, he replied. Who does know? I asked. I'm not sure anybody knows. Why not? Because we don't know what all the field offices are doing. How do we find out? I will ask, he replied after some hesitation. A week later, he returned and said, 5. I think we have 5 leads in the U.S., but I'm not sure. We walked over to Mike's office and told him. He immediately realized the issue, and we started a slow and fruitless effort over many months to rally the FBI field offices to collect and share information about AQ with FBI HQS. We failed for several reasons, but primarily because the FBI is geared to respond to crimes. They are a reactive organization. AQ had not committed any crime in the United States. There was no crime scene, no victim, no evidence, and therefore no investigation. And if there was an investigation, there was no written record, at least not